In Hebrews 10, we're told to promote love and good works. For years, Elizabeth Elliot has been pointing women to Jesus and challenging them to live a life characterized by love, good deeds, and devotion to God's Word. Welcome to Gateway to Joy, drawing on her decades of personal study and the application of God's principles as a daughter, mother, wife, and missionary, Elizabeth reminds us that anything, if offered to God, can and will become your gateway to joy.
In 1 Corinthians 13, we have a picture of what God's love is like and what our love for one another is supposed to be. It says, "This love of which I speak is slow to lose patience. It looks for a way of being constructive. It is not possessive. It is neither anxious to impress, nor does it cherish inflated ideas of its own importance." A young woman came to me just the other day and told me that she had an insanely possessive husband. She's 20 years old and he's 18. And I'm sure that he must have many insecurities, and he's probably scared to death that he's going to lose her, and he will hardly let her out of his sight. And she wanted me to give her some neat little formula for changing him. I couldn't give her a formula. I said, "There's nothing you can do about this except to accept graciously and quietly that peculiarity, that failing in your husband. You should be glad that he wants to possess you. You should be flattered by the fact that he doesn't want anybody else to have you. He wants you for himself. And then at the same time, God has to work in that man's life. So your job is to pray for him. That's by far the most important thing. And the next thing you can do is to make it as easy and pleasant as you possibly can for him to live with you and for him to realize that you do love him, that he can trust you. You must show him in every way how much you love him and how worthy of his trust you can be." C.S. Lewis wrote in A Grief Observed, which is his description of his loss of his wife, "One thing marriage has done for me, I can never again believe that religion is manufactured out of our unconscious, starved desires and is a substitute for sex. For those few years that H and I feasted on love, every mode of it, solemn and merry, romantic and realistic, sometimes as dramatic as a thunderstorm, sometimes as comfortable and unemphatic as putting on your soft slippers, no cranny of heart or body remained unsatisfied." You may recall that Lewis was not married until he was 60 years old. And he married a dying woman by her hospital bed. And then she had a remission, and they lived together very happily for, I think it was something like 2 years. "If God were a substitute for love, we ought to have lost all interest in him. Who'd bother about substitutes when he has the thing itself? But that isn't what happens. We both knew we wanted something besides one another, quite a different kind of something. A quite different kind of want. You might as well say that when lovers have one another, they will never want to read or eat or breathe. The most precious gift that marriage gave me was this constant impact of something very close and intimate, yet all the time unmistakably other, resistant, in a word, real." Are you aware of that unmistakably other being there? Resistant, and yet real, the revelation of two selves. Much of what this means, I didn't understand myself until after my second husband died. He died in September of 1973, and in December, I wrote in my journal, "This revelation of self is a fire, a purging fire." And I suppose most widows do what I've done on both occasions, gone back again and again over the course of my brief time with this man and thought of all the things that I should have done, which I left undone, and all the things which I should not have done, which I did. And it was a purging fire to see myself revealed in all my frailties and failures. I remember my dear friend, she was one of my spiritual mothers, Mom Cunningham up in Canada. When she was widowed, it was just a couple of years after my husband Jim died, and the two of us got together and discussed widowhood, and she was a beautiful, radiant-faced, white-haired old lady. And she had a wonderful Scottish accent, which I can't really imitate very accurately, but she said, "When I thought of all the things I should have done, I said to the Lord, 'Why didn't you show me?' And he said, 'Because you weren't ready to be shown.'" Are you ready to be shown today? That revelation. Ann Kimmel, some of you know Ann Kimmel and have heard her speak and read her books. And when Ann got married, she said to me, "Elizabeth, nobody has ever made me as angry as Will Anderson." And she put this in a book, so I'm not giving away any secrets. She did not know that she could be so angry. It was a revelation of two selves. Not only did she discover in Will things that she had no idea were there before she married him, things which made her furious, but she discovered this capacity for anger that she had no idea about before. Lars mentioned last night that we had a revelation of one another's sinfulness. Very shortly after we were married, he thought it was the next day. It wasn't quite that bad. I think we made it through about 10 days. But when we were married, we were moving from Massachusetts. Lars had been down in Atlanta finishing up a hospital chaplaincy training program, and so he came up to Massachusetts to marry me. And my sister was going to move into my house, and I was going to move to Atlanta with Lars, where we were renting a house. So it was a very complicated bit of logistics for me to pack up everything I owned and empty every drawer and every closet so that my sister and her family of three children and her husband could live in my house and pack all those things up and get the bed unmade and then made up fresh and the car packed and all of these things done in one morning because we were leaving that afternoon right after lunch. So it had taken a lot of planning on my part, and I had done it all. And on that morning, when I was breathing a great sigh of relief because all I had to do was fix lunch for my sister and her family and put the last few things in the suitcase, and we were going to get into the car and head for Atlanta, at about 1 o'clock, Lars informed me that morning that he really didn't feel like going to Atlanta quite yet. And I said, "You what?" He said, "What's the big rush?" He said, "You've always got to work on a schedule. Just everything's got to go just exactly the way you want it to go. And you go by the clock and you go by the calendar." He said, "What's the use of leaving this afternoon?" He said, "We don't need to leave till at least tomorrow morning." I said, "The suitcase is packed. We changed the sheets this morning. I washed the sheets this morning. My sister is coming this afternoon." He said, "You got a lot of rooms in this house. There's plenty of room for everybody. There's no problem." I said, "Make up the bed again, unmake the bed, etc." Well, you can imagine. I was furious. Lars was furious because I had won the argument. What do we do? Well, a whole year ago now, I was preparing for these talks, and it happened to be at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I wrote in my journal some things which it just seemed as though God was speaking to me and convicting me of things myself, and so I put them down on paper, and if I hadn't put them down on paper, I wouldn't remember them to this day. I strongly recommend that you keep spiritual journals because it is a great lesson, and it's a wonderful way to see the faithfulness of God. And so, very quickly, I'm going to try to get through this page because it was a revelation to me, and I hope that it will be some help to you. Like discipleship, marriage is an all-out revolution. It attacks me, and I jump to my self's defense, put up my shield, and draw my sword. But it is love that invades my world, a hitherto unknown, strange, not recognized intruder against which my practiced defenses have no power. The mystery of this man confounds me, infuriates me, and defeats me. I am humiliated when I should be humbled. Humiliation and being humble are two different things. In other words, Lars is God's Trojan horse, moved in to capture me in ways least imagined. Did I pray for humility? Here then is my opportunity, the revelation of my pride. Did I ask for Calvary love? Test the quality of your love, God says, by the cross. Did I imagine I was ready for sacrifice? Ah, yes, but on my terms. Was I willing to receive the peace that the world knows nothing about? Have turmoil then. I give you the need for my peace, God says. Lord, make me holy. Then behold your abject need. Look at the heart this man has opened to your gaze, your own heart, so dimly perceived before. Was it really open to my gift? He is the instrument of my peace. Not what you thought the instrument would look like. Of course not, dear child. Holiness demands a heavy, concentrated barrage on all that wars against it. I hope you understand why I use these military terms. We are in a battle, a spiritual battle against the headquarters of evil. And I am convinced, and all you need to do is look around, the evidence is around us all the time, that Satan's primary target every day of the world is unity. The unity of a husband and wife, the unity of the family, the unity of the church. He can't stand it. And so, is there a more relentless barrage on selfishness than the daily intimacy with one person, the same person, the one you cannot avoid or control or change or understand? He is my envoy, God says. He bears my message. And you gentlemen, please put the pronoun she in there. She is my envoy. She bears my message. She is the agent of holiness. Receive her then, and you receive me.
You've been listening to Gateway to Joy with Elizabeth Elliott, author of over 20 books, including Shadow of the Almighty, The Life and Testament of Jim Elliott. Join us next time for more encouragement and challenge from Elizabeth Elliott. This has been a production of the Bible Broadcasting Network.